welcome to another Congress Two Beers In. This is what I'm going to refer to as the back-to-school edition. I'm very pleased to be joined today by two college seniors to talk a little bit about Gen X and the experiences they've had.
Gen X?
Gen Z. Well, I'm Gen X. Eventually, we'll get there. See, it's the old brain has problems. So I'm very pleased to have Ben Waldman here with us.
Hello.
Ben is a longtime listener, first-time guest. He actually has listened to every single one of our episodes. He used to ask me questions about them early on when I'm like, why are you not worried about middle school? And the other guest is my son, Joshua Harkins, who has to listen to me all the time. So, and encounters many of what I say with very smart, insightful commentary, so I'm happy to share that with all of you today. All right, so you have something to say? All right.
Always.
Always. Yeah, it's going to be that kind of episode, folks. All right, so let me start out with asking you guys, I mean, you both getting ready to go back for your senior years. You were there. Both were on campus in the fall. Joshua, you were in the spring, and you were away. What do you expect now that you're both going back, what do you expect campuses to look like this fall?
So, I'm a rising senior at the University of Chicago, which had a pretty serious sort of like encampment, protesting some of the, stuff going on in the war in Gaza. My guess is a lot of sort of the enthusiasm for those sorts of protests is probably gone in the fall. We'll see exactly, but I think that sort of the combination of mainstream Democratic politicians sort of starting to show more sympathy towards Gaza, along with I think a little less general exasperation at the Democratic establishment now that Biden has stepped down, will probably lower the temperatures a little bit, or at least I hope, but we'll see.
And you go back, what, in about 3 weeks?
In about 3 weeks. My school starts, I think, the first day of October or something like
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, super,
really?
Super late.
And Joshua?
And so I go to Middlebury College, and our encampment started later on, from what I followed through the student journalism that was covering it and through friends' social media, our encampment started a little bit later on than most other encampments. It lasted for about a week, and at the conclusion of the week, the negotiations between student protest leaders and the administration seem to have borne fruit, that they came to an agreement of a couple of things that the administration was going to do, and the fact that the encampment was going to end, and that they would continue talking. And from the official statements that have been put out by the college and by, joint statements put out by the protesters in the college, it seems like there has been a dialogue that's kept going. I don't expect there to be another encampment. While there was that energy in the spring, I think that was, towards the end of the semester. And so I think that at the beginning of the semester, it's going to be harder for people to do that, especially because it's the beginning of the year. So I don't know. I think that the energy and the overall distaste with how American politicians have been responding to the crisis in Gaza is still there, absolutely.
And one other thing that I just want to, this is actually a question for Josh.
Oh boy.
is at least at UChicago, like the vast majority of like clearly like visible political energy was directed towards the war in Gaza. I think UChicago is generally a pretty politically engaged campus, but the vast majority of activism that I saw was somehow related to Gaza. I'm wondering if that is a UChicago specific thing or if that was also true at Middlebury.
I mean, I'll let you know. but I'm guessing that, I mean, the encampment that was at the Middlebury Quad was a solid, like, 80 to 100 students. I'm not sure if that many people were overnighting, but that was, like, a pretty consistent during the day number. And 80 to 100 students is not just a significant number, but when you consider the fact that that is, somewhere between
the population.
Right, exactly. Exactly. When you start talking about like 3% of the student body, 4%, 5% of the student body, like as part of a protest, that is pretty significant because there are a lot of people who are going to be supporting the protest who just aren't willing to actually give up their incredibly luxurious campus housing. My guess is that most of the activism was around protests with Gaza, because for the most part, activism at Middlebury is surrounding the environment. When you're in the middle of nowhere and the environment is very, you know, around, it's constantly around you.
I think that's how all environments are, guys.
when nature is constantly around you, sorry, and you're not just in a big block of concrete and asphalt, with a couple of little, you know, parks that the city government's been forced to do, that's when people get really invested in protecting that, and so that's what Middlebury's activism and what activist clubs are more about.
And what activism do you remember at UChicago pre-Hamas? What kind of stuff in Israel situation? What was going on?
So I think honestly there's kind of, UChicago has a lot of sort of various politically affiliated clubs. There's a very prominent Institute of Politics that
right.
I know David
yeah.
Axelrod was affiliated with for a while, and a lot of sort of relatively big name politicians and political adjacent figures sort of come through. But actually the thing that sort of sticks with me most is UChicago has pretty consistently had people who are affiliated with the Israeli government somehow teach classes. And so, for example, I remember walking into a building and someone tried to hand me a flyer protesting a class being taught by an Israeli general. I think it was about counterterrorism. And so actually, pro-Palestinian groups have had sort of a notable presence on campus for a while prior to the war. Now, the extent to which I remember that is probably largely because I'm Jewish, and so those sorts of things are more memorable to me. But I do think that Israel-Palestine was already one of the more prominent political issues for student activists.
And do you guys think that this is going to dampen your generation's interest in trying to vote this time? It's always difficult to get people out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends. The conversations that I've had with friends, typically, I mean, it's almost split, where half of folks are saying something along the lines of, I'm not going to vote, or I'm going to vote third party. And then the other half, those who are most vocal about this, and the other half are just saying, well, I'm going to vote third party. So I think that in terms of getting people engaged with the process, as long as we're getting those on the fence people to just vote at all, I don't really think this is going to dampen turnout. I think that, especially if the voice of the Democratic Party now, Kamala Harris, continues to shift farther and farther toward, as what she said, like that there needs to be a ceasefire in Gaza, like that is a shift from what has been said by almost all mainstream politicians that aren't on the left, that there's going to be increased interest in voting.
I think the other thing is that I think a lot of the people who would vote for someone besides Kamala Harris or not vote over the issue of Gaza are people who would find an excuse to not vote for Kamala Harris either way. Because I don't think there's really a positive case to be made that Donald Trump would be better
right.
for Palestine.
Right.
And so I don't think that they're... Maybe this is an inaccurate assessment of other Gen Z voters, obviously. But it's really hard for me to imagine the type of voter who is really uniquely far left on Israel-Palestine, but is fine with all of Kamala Harris's other policies, and if she made more rhetorical motions to the left on this issue, would just fall in line. But, you know, voters are idiosyncratic. I am not the median voter. I have no idea.
Right, no, and that's what's interesting. Both of you grew up in the D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the things that you were interested in talking about, and we can go ahead and just kind of segue into it now, is even local races.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
You are, Joshua, I think you're voting absentee in Maryland.
I am.
Ben, are you voting in Illinois or Maryland?
I am also planning to vote absentee
in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like kind of a race going on,
mm-hmm.
A Senate race, which wasn't a race 3 months ago.
No.
And all of a sudden is.
I'm not sure it is, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, well, go for it. Why do you think it's not a race? I mean, the polls are showing it 50-50 with, what, about 8% undecided, which is, or 16. 16, is it 42, 42, 44, 44, something like that?
I think
that's 46, 46.
Yeah,
46, 46,
yeah.
So it's only 8%
yeah.
undecided.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically when you get to Labor Day,
mm-hmm.
you kind of lock in where you're going to be. So what are you thinking?
I mean, so the first election cycle that I, like, really paid close attention to to was in 2016, where I was sort of obsessively checking 538 in, you know, my, like, middle school study hall period, of course, and that's why I'm on this podcast.
There
right
you
now.
Go. Yeah.
But one of sort of the memories that I have is checking 538 and seeing the 2016 Senate race in Indiana between Evan Bayh. Okay, excellent. Got the pronunciation correct. And Todd Young. Evan Bayh was running for his old Senate seat that he had vacated because he didn't run for re-election in 2010. Probably a good decision for him. And so he was running in 2016, and the poll showed him with, like, a 20-point lead in August in Indiana. He was, we just checked this before the podcast, I think he was at, like, 54% of the vote.
Yeah, something,
absurd. And the 538 model showed him with, like, a 50-50 toss-up chance. And I looked at that polling average, and I was like, why on earth is this the way that it is? And the model assumed that, like, Indiana, obviously a red state. Obama won it in 2008, but, you know, like, whatever. He almost won North Dakota in 2008, like, whatever. And the model was just like, well, the voters are probably going to come home. And, you know, Larry Hogan, I think, has done a lot to differentiate himself from the Republican Party. But fundamentally, Maryland is a state that voted for Joe Biden by, like, 30-plus points. And I just, I find it really hard to believe that a state that voted for Joe Biden by 30-plus points is going to send someone who's going to vote for Mitch McConnell for majority leader. Or is Thune going to be the majority leader? Or
most likely.
Yeah.
Or Thune or Cornyn. So
yes,
Cornyn's got a real good shot,
John.
Too.
Exactly.
One
some
of the
senator
Johns.
Who represents...
Well, maybe. There are some other people in the wings, but it's a fair point.
Right.
It's a fair point.
And, you know, like, I certainly could be proven wrong, but, I mean, we saw Phil Bredesen run in Tennessee in 2018. He wasn't leading by the same margin, but he was running a very competitive race, and he loses by 10 points. Steve Bullock, again, running against an incumbent senator, so a little different, but that was, what, like, 2020 or 2022? Lost by 10 points. Like, I just, it's really hard to overcome a state's partisanship unless your name is John Tester, and even he might not be doing it this cycle. So we'll see.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that Hogan has name recognition and continues to pander farther and farther to the left. Which is very interesting, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, I think that there was some abortion protection legislation that had to be passed over his veto,
mm-hmm.
or over a pocket veto of some sort, and then during the race, as Angela Alsobrooks has made the race really very firmly about women's health care and
mm-hmm.
protecting abortion, all of a sudden Hogan comes out in support of a woman's right to choose, says he will not sign, will not put his name on and or vote for an abortion ban in Congress, and that, like, will actively vote for a woman's right to choose in the Senate. So it just seems like all of a sudden now that he needs to win the middle voter, he's moving further and further to the left after having to move a little bit to the right in the primary so that he could make friends with the Trump wing of the Maryland Republican Party.
And I think one other thing, just when we talk about the Trump wing, that I think is really interesting, is Trump did technically endorse Hogan, and Hogan sort of declined the endorsement or sort of awkwardly parried it away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing, I was talking actually to my dad about this, and my speculation is that Trump, who dislikes Larry Hogan, did that to sink his chances. I have
that's
true.
It's not ridiculous.
But I think Trump, you know, like, cares a lot more about interpersonal relationships than he does policy, and that strikes me as not implausible. I think one other thing that's worth
especially
mentioning,
after Hogan sent, was like, Maryland National Guard troops were some of the first on January 6th
right.
in the district, and was very openly anti-whatever
mm-hmm.
Trump was doing.
Right.
Britain.
One other thing, and I think that, I'm curious what Josh's perspective is on this, because he goes to college in another state with a pretty moderate Republican governor in Phil Scott. I think Larry Hogan is more conservative than people give him credit for, and people don't realize that because the Democrats had two supermajorities for, I think, both the entirety of both of his terms when he was governor of Maryland. Whereas someone like Phil Scott or Charlie Baker, like, truly is more moderate than Larry Hogan. Like, Larry Hogan is moderate in the sense that, like, he did not, like, bend the knee to Trump as aggressively, or if at all, than,
right.
like, other sort of Republicans. But, like, he is a somewhat conservative guy. It's just that those policy impulses couldn't really manifest themselves in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, if you see,
mm-hmm.
or if you think that Harris is going to win the state,
mm-hmm.
it's going to win the state fairly handily.
Going to go out on a limb and say that
she's going to win that state. She's going to win 60-40, let's
uh-huh.
say. or even 55-45, but I think 60-40 is not out of the realm of reasonable.
Oh, I think it's 65-35 or 70-35.
Well, let's go 60-40 just for the sake of this.
Sure.
That means that 1 in 6 voters who vote for an African-American woman to be president have to vote against an African-American woman to be senator.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be one of those barriers that have crossed already,
mm-hmm.
that at least where I'm from in the deeper South, sometimes is difficult. So I think you guys are right that this will... This is not one of the races I'm concerned about. There are some Senate races
mm-hmm.
that I think may be a problem for Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of races that could be problems for Republicans. This really doesn't make the top 7 or 8 in my book.
I think just in terms of comparing it to Vermont, I think that we should look at like Vermont and New Hampshire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both have 2 Democratic senators. Both have Republican governors,
mm-hmm.
and I do think that Maryland falls a lot more into the Vermont category of states, which is that
mm-hmm.
it is a state that consistently, you know,
mm-hmm.
since whatever Reagan will vote Democratic on just
mm-hmm.
about everything. But when it comes to local issues, you know, you can be a little bit more pro-business, pro-small business
right.
with the Republicans, and that's fine, and that's something that Phil Scott has consistently done. Whereas in New Hampshire, that is much more of an actual swing state where people are splitting tickets because it's more retail politics. It's just a little different. And they could theoretically send a Republican to the Senate, whereas I just don't see that happening in Maryland. It just isn't going to happen.
Former governor of New Hampshire just came out today and endorsed the Democrat, and I think he was a former Republican governor. Because he said the race that's being run by the Republican is so nasty, in his 50 years of politics, he's never seen one, which plays exactly to your point of it being very much retail politics.
Which former governor was it? Do you remember?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I can look as we're going. When you guys start going again. All right, so how do we, what do you guys kind of expect as youth? I mean, I know I talked to Joshua some about this. He's like, yeah, Dad, thanks for leaving this world to us.
Mm-hmm.
As we move forward, I know I'm starting to see for the first time, and as people who've listened to the podcast or have had to suffer through me lecturing in the past, no, I'm into the budget. I'm
mm-hmm.
into appropriations. I'm into deficits and debt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to see for the first time a couple of headlines coming in from some of my news sources saying,
mm-hmm.
Who has the best plan to try to cut back the deficit?
Mm-hmm.
Does this matter at all anymore? Does
mm-hmm.
anybody care? What is it that you guys are hoping to see out of whatever new Congress we have?
So I think for me, one of my pet issues is I am really invested in sort of public transit and high-speed rail. And that's something that I think I've seen a lot of pushes for on the Democratic side, just sort of following random people on Twitter and seeing it discussed a lot. And I think that sort of something like high-speed rail or sort of various infrastructure bills are good ways to sort of find bipartisan ground on things like climate that maybe Republicans are not normally as cooperative on. And I think, you know, there are things like housing, transportation. Like, there's a lot of stuff that probably would be really good if we built more of it in this country. and so I think that infrastructure, you know, I mean, I'm sure every week is going to be infrastructure week again.
Well, but in Biden's defense, he actually got infrastructure.
No, right, that's my point.
I mean, Trump had infrastructure week and didn't do anything with it.
Right, but I wanted to make an infrastructure week joke because I thought it was funny in the Trump administration.
Fair enough.
But I do think that's one of those things where every time there's an infrastructure bill passed, like, Biden's infrastructure bill, to me, seemed great. Ton of funding for Amtrak, ton of funding for various things that seem really good to me as sort of an uninformed, you know, non-budget guy. But
an informed transportation guy.
Exactly. And I think that it's one of those things where, like, it's good, but it's probably not enough, especially on things like housing.
Yeah.
Where I think the issue, I mean, again, not a huge housing policy guy, but a lot of housing policy stuff seems like if you cut back a lot of the regulation, you don't even need to give that much funding. And that's really a thing where, if Republicans win the Senate, which seems likely, like, cutting regulation seems like something there should hopefully be sort of some bipartisan agreement on. But I'm not optimistic that any sort of particularly big partisan priority is going to be able to get through, on the assumption that it rarely does.
Yeah. Listen, I definitely agree with the transportation and the housing takes. I'd also love to see some action on reducing tuition in some way, shape, or form, really any way, shape, or form, all of the ways, shapes, and forms. additionally, like, eliminating student debt in ways that the government has kind of has screwed over student borrowers over the past many decades. And as a big, as someone who majors in IR, international relations, I would love to see a more bipartisan push to, like, in the Congress, even just a bunch of like joint, what are they called? Joint statements, joint measures.
You want politics to stop at the water's edge again?
Right. I just want some joint resolutions. There we go. I want some joint resolutions that say, like, you know, we're not going to back out of NATO, which I didn't think we would need, but given a lot of the rhetoric that's been coming from the right, I would just love for us to, you know, remember that we're a part of this global community and that we prop it up in a lot of ways and that it's kind of our job to keep it going. One of the things I will say, since, Mark, you brought up Dad, you brought up the budget, I would love, and this is never going to happen, but I would love if politicians would stop using the budget as a crutch, because every time that something gets passed that costs money, it gets passed because it's necessary. Infrastructure was necessary.
Yep.
COVID money, like
relief,
the checks,
yep.
COVID relief was necessary. Everything was, what was it, the Build Back Better, the Inflation Reduction Act? That was necessary. And then every time that, you know, something would be great but isn't politically feasible or expedient for some people, all of a sudden it's because we can't pay for it. As if we don't spend $900 billion on the defense budget every year, as if we weren't able to pass these two different trillion-dollar appropriations. I'm a little peeved by that.
So, yeah, I mean, and I think you reflect what many voters have in their pocket, which is, when they don't support what I want, then it's ridiculous. But when they support all these things I don't want, that's also ridiculous. And the spending can be, it's pretty dramatic right now. We're still running $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion deficits, which is...
which was the debt maybe 40 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Less so. Yeah.
We didn't know how good we had it under Bill Clinton.
No.
Well, even
if either of us were born.
Even before then. I mean, well, the truth of the matter is, I mean, historically, everybody believed that we should try to balance a budget until about the mid-70s. And that's where, and if we're going to spend money, we need to raise taxes to counter it. There's a good Substack out there from a former colleague of mine called John, whose name is John Haskell. If you haven't had a chance to go do it, he's just done a series on the debt and the deficit in general. He's releasing, he's in the middle, I think he's just released his third part. It's a really good little read. Each one doesn't take very much. So yeah, go see John Haskell's stuff. He's got good historical things here. And it was interesting to hear what he had to say about the fact that the deficit and the debt so crazy. And his most recent one that came out today was actually about Grahams, Rudman, Hollings. For those of my listeners who've been around since the mid-80s, which is about the time I started in Congress, these are guys who dreamed up sequestration. The idea being that if we can't figure out on our own to raise money if we're going to spend, then we'll institute a mechanism that forces us to by doing across-the-board cuts. And they were trying to balance the budget by 19... I believe it was 1996. So earlier than that, they were trying to balance the budget. And the way that Congress got around it, because obviously it didn't happen until, well, it did happen by 1997. Kinda. Depends on how you count Social Security.
For listeners, it didn't happen.
That's, well, depends on how you count those deposits versus those the things you have to pay later. But Congress got around it by saying, okay, rather than cut, you know, $400 billion a year out of everything, we'll change the goals. We'll change those, because it was in law that they had to cut this amount. And if they didn't, it was sequestered. And so at the end of every year, they changed it the same way we did with the Budget Control Act back in 2011, where we put strict caps on how much spending we were going to do. And then for the last 4 years of that 10 years, we're like, As Joshua said, it's important. We want to make sure we have enough money for defense. So that is kind of the issue, right? If we're going to start cutting from somewhere, where do we start cutting? And every organization, every group, every demographic has a different point of view on that. And we mm-hmm. haven't been able to come to a consensus mm-hmm. on where to do it. Your mm-hmm. demographic thinks...
Oh, I think that we should be cutting Social Security and Medicare. I think that that is... We are
not old people.
Because, right, come on. I mean, with Social Security the way that it is, I'm going to be paying... for other people to retire, and I already have been paying mm-hmm. for other people to retire, and I'm not going to get 100% of my benefits. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Y'all have had it too good for too long, and truly, and it's time that some changes were made, and you know, 70%, a cut right now to 70%, is better than nothing.
Another way to do it is just to tax more and bring more mm-hmm. money in.
I'm also okay with that as long as we start taxing the old people.
Yeah. No, that's the way you do it is 1% on everybody.
Right, especially because it's the people who were paying in who should get what they paid into it. So if you want more now, then you should have to pay in more now, whereas what I'm paying in should just be set aside for when I retire.
I think, so personally, I would like to see the defense budget cut pretty substantially. I think my guess is that a lot of Gen Z voters are, after, I mean, we were raised during, like, the sort of end of Iraq, or depending on how you want to count it.
We were born after 9/11.
Yeah,
we were
born after 9/11. We
They're
sort
not.
Of grew up in the context of the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think a lot of Gen Z voters don't see the U.S. as the world's policeman, do not see the U.S. as someone that should necessarily be intervening all that much abroad. I think, at least for me personally, and I think Ukraine is probably a pretty big sort of exception to this, because I think there's sort of a moral quality to the conflict in Ukraine where people feel like Russia is being, you know, an aggressor, because they are.
Right.
And so there's sort of a moral obligation to help defend a country against sort of basically a pseudo-colonizer.
A bully.
Yeah,
a bully. Right? Like it comes down to like very basic identity, bully versus
so
bully.
So when you start talking about pulling back, mm-hmm. that means things like, okay, Taiwan, you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. So I think... like, this is why, I think one of the, so, as a not super informed foreign policy voter, like, my initial impulse is, like, in general, the U.S. government probably does too much abroad. Then when you ask me, should we not be defending Taiwan, my thought is, no, obviously we need to defend Taiwan, and I don't know how to reconcile those things.
Well, so
I think this is one place
yeah.
where I am representative of the median voter, in that
yeah.
in the abstract,
no,
I would like there to be cuts,
yeah.
but, like, the one place where I think there should be cuts made is probably, like, I don't think we need to be giving Israel this much money, and I think that if we do, we should maybe be conditioning it on more stuff. The one, just one other thing on sort of the balancing the budget type deal. I think there's a big sort of sense among Gen Z voters that people who grew, or boomers and to a lesser extent Gen Xers, kind of got lucky in the sense that they were able to buy homes and go to college and get jobs much, much more. Like a lot of these financial, like big financial milestones in their life were just much easier because of sort of the social situation and economy they were raised in. And so, you know, people, there are all these jokes going around, like, social media, where people who are, you know, like, 40 plus will say, like, well, why don't you just go and buy a house for $500, like I did back in 1860, right? And, like, you can't do that.
Right.
Right? And so, to the extent that young people think older people are kind of free-riding on the economic conditions they happen to grow up into, like, they want that to be taxed more. And I agree with that.
Going back to the defense budget mm-hmm. cuts, just for a moment, I think that there mm-hmm. I am slightly more informed than you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in that realm, I would say, for example, not knowing the specifics, 12 aircraft carriers is perhaps, mm-hmm. and therefore 12 aircraft carrier, well, groups,
right.
is perhaps a few more than necessary. I think, and you know, feel free to, in the comments, call me out as crazy for saying that I think that we can defend our allies in the Mediterranean, Africa, you know, Europe, and the Northern Europe, and also Taiwan,
mm-hmm.
with fewer than 12 aircraft carrier groups.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, two are always in dry dock, it
right.
feels like, anyway.
Right.
So I think that it's things like that. One of the things that I will say, an interesting little trend that's going on, is the fact that I think it's except for the Marine Corps, none of the... An interesting trend going on in relation to, Ben, what you were saying about not seeing the military as the police force
mm-hmm.
and not having kind of the same opinion of the U.S. military that maybe our I was about to say ancestors, but our elders have is that I think the stat I saw is that every, and I'll find it eventually, every branch except for the Marine Corps are missing recruitment goals.
Yeah, I think
that they aren't able to recruit younger people because it's kind of like, well, if you grow up for, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 years just seeing people going to fight useless wars, or it's really been set for some, I mean, for some people since World War II, before there was a real sense of moral imperative for fighting a war, and you know, you can debate Korea, you can debate Vietnam, you can
9/11, I think, is
whatever. Well, sure, but it's been a while since there was this sense of we all need to come together to defeat evil, instead of just seeing wars that take decades where we get nothing, where nothing happens, and Iraq for that matter.
And Iraq,
That it's hard to recruit people who grew up amid that. Also, like, you know, other place where we could find budget cuts. I'm tired of taking my laptop out of my bag on airplanes. I think that we could cut TSA. Which I say as a joke, but I think that's going to be. I mean, you want to talk about cuts? I mean, you can end up cutting funding for payroll in the Department of Defense when all of a sudden there's no one to pay the payroll to.
So what's interesting about that, I think some of this is also unemployment rates being incredibly low. When unemployment is high, I think it's much easier for the military to find recruits.
Oh.
Because it's the best alternative. But for the two of you, for instance, that's probably not the best alternative right now. There are going to be a lot of other options for looking at things.
So I think that's definitely true.
And I real quick, I felt that attack on not knowing what I'm doing after college. I absolutely did.
So for context, my roommate in college is hopefully going to be a fighter pilot in the Navy after he graduates. And I know that he was sort of on the fence about that. And part of the reason that he decided to do it was because he did an internship to, you know, do a banking or to do some sort of banking job, did it, and basically found it incredibly boring.
Right.
But when he was making this decision, one of the things he had to grapple with is, like, he could have gone into banking, probably done really, like, he's a smart guy, I'm sure he would have done well as a banker, and he would have made way more money than he's going to make in the military. Like, a government pension is great, and, like, he loves flying, like, he loves fighter planes, so, like, it made sense for him. But, like, unless you have a really strong pull to the military, because, you know, you're nerd about fighter planes.
Or familial.
Exactly. Yeah. It's pretty hard to draw those people in.
And we also now, I mean, back before World War II, it was the fact that people weren't healthy enough and we didn't have that. Now we've got drug screens that people are having a hard time passing, which is also...
Kids these days.
I know, right? which is also what's causing problems with the Border Patrol agents as well, trying to fill all those billets.
Excellent example of where some regulation cutting could help us out.
Well, yeah, and thinking about that, I mean, I read also about England all the time. I'm into the UK politics because sometimes this stuff gets too hard for me.
Uh-huh.
And they're talking about right now, because they're talking about Grenfell, where they had a huge fire about 10 years ago. It was a high rise, and it turned out that the insulation, what they call the cladding, was flammable. And people died who didn't necessarily have to die. And now they just released this huge report, 300-page report, that essentially said the government let everybody down by cutting regulation and by making it easier for people to put the wrong things up. So the cutting regulation thing can go both ways. I mean, you got to be, you know, do you really want to be cutting regulation at FDA, food and drugs? Do you want there to be less? Do you want USDA meat inspectors to be doing less inspections?
Well, I think one thing just on the topic of regulation is I think it's very easy to sort of point to specific examples of things regulation could have stopped and ignore the sort of background waste that it causes. So, like, to use an example that was brought up earlier in the podcast, when Josh was talking about cutting the TSA, right? I read a stat somewhere, and this could be wrong. I haven't verified it. That
people are saying.
Yeah, many people are saying. going through security checks at TSA has cost more human hours than the lives lost on 9/11.
Oh, sure.
And
that's absolutely true.
And so, like, obviously, 9/11 is bad. We should be doing what we can to prevent 9/11s. But no one thinks about all of the sort of background waste that things like the TSA cause. And to be clear, I'm not saying we should get rid of the TSA.
Right.
But there are other sort of more benign examples where, like, you know, like, maybe that fire, like, caused some death that could happen in the UK, but also maybe cutting those regulations stopped, like, a bunch of people from being homeless. Like, there is a real benefit to cutting some of those regulations.
It's yeah. a hard, it's sometimes a hard give and take.
Yeah.
And that's what our politicians have to balance all the time. Mm-hmm. So both of you have recently spent time overseas.
Yes.
I think, Joshua, you did it this winter and spring.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, you were there about a year ago.
Yeah, I was there last summer and then this fall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that one of our presidential candidates is saying, former President Trump,
mm-hmm.
is that we are seen weaker now with our allies than when he was the president. Do you have an impression, I mean, were people talking to you about the American, I mean, more for Joshua, probably because it's a little bit closer to the election, about how people are looking at our election and what are they thinking about?
Absolutely. One of the things I will say is that if President Trump talked to a single person whose job wasn't to kiss up to him, because I do think that while there are smart people who work for him, I think that a lot of them are kind of in a yes man position, and especially allies whose jobs, any real people, from abroad, I think that he would find that his understanding of the situation is a little bit different from the actual reality. People are always invested in the U.S. elections because we are one of the, you know, we're the second largest democracy, we're one of the oldest democracies in the world, we are undoubtedly the most powerful democracy economically, militarily, so it's important to everyone, no matter where you are, because it has the ability to affect everyone's daily lives.
When the United States sneezes, everybody else catches a cold.
Exactly.
COVID. And
I'm not sure the U.S. was the one that sneezed there, Josh, to be honest.
Perhaps. So there, people are very interested in what's going on, and people are also very interested. So I think we both spent time, Ben and I were both in Paris, just at different times. We're studying abroad in Paris. And the French, albeit having withdrawn from some sort of military hierarchy in NATO, are still a part of NATO, are still a part, are a backbone of the European Union, and as such, see bilateralism and global cooperation as a good thing. Like, the Euro, the Eurozone, the Schengen area, all of these great hallmarks of global cooperation. And so they, by and large, like to see people in the United States who also support that. That's not to say that there isn't a growing part of the right in France or of populism
or Italy
on either side,
or
right?
In Germany.
I mean, absolutely. In the French elections, so I got to be there for both legislative French elections and for the European Parliament elections in France, and the far right won a significant victory in the European Parliament elections. And in the legislative elections, did not get the significant victory they were hoping for, but did far better than they had ever done in legislative elections, and are now, like, in second or third place, just doing very well for themselves. So there are absolutely people who are voting on for far-right candidates, and who are voting from a sense of trying to kind of protect France and the EU from waves and waves and waves of immigration and of kind of the of what they see as France being changed very quickly in their lifetimes. But by and large, they still like that the EU exists. It's just that, just like with the U.S. federal government, they want increased subsidy checks and they also want to pay less. It's like everyone all over the world.
Yes. So I have one snarky comment and then one serious thing to say.
Only one.
So I'll start with the snarky comment, which is that luckily all of these countries have a long history of democratic traditions that could never be sort of usurped by a right-wing dictator of some kind.
Snark so noted.
And the serious comment is that I think one thing that was pretty striking to me, more so reading about these far-right parties than particularly experiencing them, is that their far-right populism is pretty concentrated towards, like, waves of immigration from, you know, like, basically countries that are not predominantly white. And there's a large element of kind of race, or to my understanding, there's a large element of racism there. And so unlike Republicans in the U.S. who are pretty skeptical of anything that is not America, I think far-right populists in Europe tend to be pretty friendly to international cooperation generally. They're just sort of very hostile to a specific group of people coming in. And so far-right, like, in the U.S., when I think far-right, I think, oh, isolationism. I don't think that's true everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, and we also saw that there's always an element to, once you have power, how are you going to wield it? Take Maloney in Italy, where the far-right party, the farthest right that's been elected since Mussolini was in power. A far-right dictator who came to power in a democratic country. But once she came to power, all of a sudden she was playing ball on the international stage very quickly.
Right.
She was... while still having some of her farther right politics imbued into statements that the G7 was making, like, was still a participant of the G7 and was still saying things that that were necessary to be a part of the kind of Western order and to be part of that leadership. So I absolutely agree that, you know, even with all the things that a person like a politician like Marine Le Pen will say in France, like, at the end of the day, probably not going to be withdrawing from NATO, probably not going to be withdrawing from the EU, just going to want to try to make it work for them.
I mean, do you see parallels in the U.S. system or hope there that even if we have President Trump come back in again, that there will, he may not be able to govern as far to the right as some might like?
Well,
similar?
I think Trump is a really sort of interesting character for many reasons, obviously. But I think one of the sort of really interesting things to him about me is that he has basically no deeply held ideological commitments of any kind.
it does seem that way.
And so, like, I'm not even, like, obviously Trump is sort of closely affiliated with far-right parts of the Republican Party. But I don't see him, like, the reason why I find Trump a threatening figure is not really because I see him as particularly far-right, but because I see him as just sort of an irrational, unstable person who I think is a threat to American democracy.
A loose cannon, right?
But I think that, like, having Trump is extraordinarily different from having someone like, say, Ted Cruz, who I sincerely disagree with on a lot of things, of course, but I think genuinely has ideological commitments and tries to make policy in accordance with them. And so I think in some ways, like, I think that I would rather have someone like Ted Cruz as president because I don't think he's going to accidentally start a global nuclear war. But I think Ted Cruz could be a lot more politically dangerous towards, like, my policy opinions.
Right.
Because he would actually act in accordance with his beliefs. And I think that in Europe, where there's no Trump-like, like, there are Trump-like figures, but there's no one quite like Trump. You see these people who moderate their ideological opinions, but still have them. Whereas, like, I genuinely have no idea what policy would be passed in day one of the Trump administration. I assume sort of various, congressional Republican leaders would push him towards things like tax cuts. But, like, who knows? Like, maybe he'll switch parties and, like, become the first libertarian president. Like, that's obviously not going to happen. But, like,
but
could
it?
Who knows?
Right, but it's still, it's in the discussion.
Right.
To some degree. On either of your campuses, is there any kind of a Republican student body that debates somewhat with a Democratic student body?
My answer will be quick and easy, as opposed to University of Chicago, probably. No. I think that there was, which quite frankly does make for weakening of the discourse. And there have been a number of op-eds in our student newspaper about the fact that Middlebury is so one-sided that it can make anybody swimming against that tide nervous to speak up at all. And I see that as a great problem, that you need more diversity of thought in terms of the political system, because I think that my freshman year there was like Middlebury Democrats and there were 25 people at that table. Everybody wanted to sign up. There were 5 people standing behind it.
And these were clubs.
At a clubs fair. And there were 2 people at the Middlebury Republicans table, and one of them was really, like, it wasn't that he didn't want to be there, it was just that he was preoccupied. In the same way that there is a Planned Parenthood club that supports Planned Parenthood at Middlebury that always has a lot of interest in the handful of things that they do every semester, and there, I think, isn't a pro-life club, whereas there was maybe 3 years ago with one person standing there. So, yeah, definitely.
Not a lot of life there, you would say.
But with the fading of Trump, that is... I mean, I saw some of that at Swarthmore, too, right? I mean, I went to a very liberal college, but I was there from 83 to 87, so I was there during the Reagan years.
Sorry, 19 or 18?
Yeah. Thank you so much. Tip your waiters on the way out. So, the because of Reagan being there, there was actually a reasonably vibrant Republican club.
Yeah.
That in this bastion of liberalism, which later produced the candidate in 88, Mike Dukakis.
Mm-hmm. What about UChicago?
So I think UChicago is an outlier because the Chicago School is obviously, the economics department at UChicago is hugely influential. The Chicago School of Economics, you know, it's been hugely influential in American economic thought and in policymaking. And that tends to be sort of very libertarian leaning. So there are a lot of people at UChicago who I would consider libertarian, a lot of economics majors, a lot of business majors. But I don't think there's a particularly strong sort of pro-Trump presence. Obviously, Chicago is a bigger school than Middlebury, so just like by virtue of having more students, there will be sort of, there are a couple of like conservative, I would say, social media antagonists who like to sort of make hay and, you know, entertain themselves and maybe do a little bit of activism, but who knows. But I think that there is a pretty strong sort of like moderate right, libertarian adjacent economics sort of presence on campus. That being said, despite sort of its free speech reputation and its historical sympathies for libertarian economic policies, it's still a very left-wing campus. Certainly the influence of protesters on Israel and Palestine is far more than I've ever noticed anything from like people on the right. And in general, like I would say, like in terms of the overall American electorate, I'm pretty liberal. In terms of UChicago, I am probably a little bit conservative, if not like right in the middle.
Right. I think that's true on a lot of college campuses. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I think Democrats were somewhat concerned that students may not be willing to come out because of what's going on in the Middle East. Other thoughts or ideas that you guys want to get across? We're a little over 45 minutes. That's about the time period at which people start to turn off.
Well, I would never turn off an episode of Just 2 Beers In before it reached its conclusion.
Oh, there's one thing that I do have to tell you to listeners. When Joshua mentioned, you know, you can put it into the comments. We don't have a comment section. But you can send something directly to me if you want to at mark.harkins@georgetown.edu. You guys know that, mark.harkins@georgetown.edu. Mm-hmm. And there's been an idea of me trying to put something into show notes. If I can figure out show notes, I'll put something in about Haskell's thing. But otherwise, look up John Haskell on Substack. And just so you know, both these guys are 21. Mm-hmm. We did go ahead and do Congress 2 Beers In with a beer. Both of these guys have been gamely trying to take down a three-notched brewing company ales of various kinds from Virginia.
I'm drinking the Duke of Clouds Hazy IPA, which, as someone who likes very white wine and not a whole lot of strength in anything, absolutely go Devils. I've been enjoying this one.
I've been drinking the Minuteman, which is apparently Virginia's juiciest IPA. It's very good. I would highly recommend. It was also kindly provided to me by one Mark Harkins.
Yes, luckily he's over 21, so this is all legal. All right, well, gentlemen, thank you very much. I think it's been very helpful. Yes,
there is one last thing that I do want to plug very quickly, which is I think that one thing that I have seen... So I think that one thing is that's maybe worth discussing very briefly is the influence of newer members of Congress, like the Squad, sort of on the left, and their appeal to Gen Z voters. One thing that I just want to say about me personally, and I think this might be a semi-widely shared opinion, although Josh can hop in to correct me, is that
or rebuke you.
Yeah, exactly. is that I think someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has demonstrated to me at least a really impressive ability to do actual policymaking.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I think that sort of a lot of people in Gen Z like people on the far left because, you know, Gen Z tends to be a pretty progressive generation. But unlike some of the members of the Tea Party or certain members of the far left, there's also an appreciation for actual policymaking. And so people, like, I don't think are voting for members of the squad just because they're agitators, but because they are actually doing a lot to advance sort of left-wing priorities. And there was a recent sort of, you know, disagreement between Jill Stein and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think it played out on, like, various social media platforms. But I think that there is real desire, not just for, you know, like, kooks like Jill Stein, but people who are actually invested in, you know, making things better.
And to that point real quick, and then I'll let Joshua go. Two of the of the squad members lost primaries.
Right.
And I think it's, to your point, it's because they weren't policymakers.
Right.
They were trying to make names nationally, and they lost touch with their districts back home.
Yeah, I would agree, and the one thing that I would say is, as having just been around my dad for so long and understanding that sometimes you have to compromise, is that I agree until the point where compromise is not a word that's used. Because I think that a lot of times young people have seen kind of the end results of big social movements and of policy and legislative pushes, but they haven't seen the fact that sometimes you do have to compromise and bide your time or just accept that you aren't going to get everything, right? Not to say that people shouldn't get participation trophies. I think participation trophies are kind of great. Always made me feel welcome. But I think that there does need to be an acknowledgement, right? Like the Green New Deal, great idea. I think some of the elements have made their way into subsequent
The Inflation Reduction Act.
Right. Into subsequent pieces of legislation. However, that took compromise, which is something that AOC was willing to do, but something that a lot of times people who aren't as invested in the legislative process aren't willing to see happen.
Right. I think...
Give compromise a chance.
Right. Like, I remember, like, I don't think someone, like, the left-wing... Like, yeah, I mean, we've seen people like Cori Bush, or who was the other one who lost their primary?
Montero Jones.
Yes, Montero Jones. Wait, No.
Bowman, sorry.
Not Jones. Bowman. Yeah, but I think that those people are sort of, like, the left-wing equivalent of, like, Tom Cole, the senator from Oklahoma, whose name was Dr. No, or, like, Ron Paul, or, like, people who...
Cover.
Okay.
Cole's the guy who's actually trying to make appropriations work. I'll talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Tom Coburn,
right? Like, those people are not the types of people who are winning their primaries with the margins that people like AOC do.
So, let me talk real quick about appropriations. Some of you, we may get another podcast in before now on October the 1st, hopefully, and we'll talk more deeply about this, but as we speak right now, Republicans are getting ready to do a whip count to see if they can pass legislation which, to Ben's point, isn't going to go anywhere, would do a continuing resolution to March and would add some other voter restrictions legislation that will never pass the Senate, will never make it to off of President Biden's desk. And then we'll get into the real brass tacks of probably doing a continuing resolution into December. And then we will figure out after the elections whether we can actually do full year appropriations before the end of this particular Congress. We don't know. It's a great unknown. Speaker Johnson's got some of the same difficulties that were before him with Speaker McCarthy, and I'm guessing that my guests here are like, just get over it and get it done.
I think that's probably my policy-related attitude, but I do, I mean, if we're going way over, maybe this, you guys should save this for another episode, but I did actually have some legislative process type questions, Mark, if you want to answer some of them.
Go for it. You guys can cut out if you need to.
Okay.
If anyone is still listening at this point.
So, one thing that actually has been really interesting to me is I have not heard, obviously there have been a variety of fights over the Speaker of the House and Republicans' ability to form a governing majority, in the House. But it seems like Johnson has done a reasonably good job of at least preventing, like, votes to take him out of the speakership.
He faced one down.
Mm-hmm.
He did have one. The Democrats happened to support him.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't...
So what is allowing... Like, how has he been able to form a slightly more cohesive majority than McCarthy? Or has there just not been the type of vote that's going to fracture the caucus yet?
He hasn't been as much of an annoyance to
mm-hmm.
the Democrats
mm-hmm.
as McCarthy was.
Okay.
When McCarthy decided September last year to go ahead and put a continuing resolution on the floor on a Saturday, he hadn't actually shared it with the Democrats beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he came to, you know, he never came to them to ask for their support to help him
mm-hmm.
maintain his speakership. Now, Johnson never came to them
mm-hmm.
saying, "Democrats, I need your support to maintain my speakership."
Mm-hmm.
But he did speak with them when he was trying to put together the Ukraine
mm-hmm.
And the Asian Pacific,
mm-hmm.
Israel, Hamas,
mm-hmm.
Supplemental.
Mm-hmm.
He did ask Democrats for their point of view on what it should be. He didn't just thrust it upon them.
Mm-hmm.
So the Democrats had a more willingness
mm-hmm.
to see him stay in that position.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with McCarthy, it's like, he doesn't really want our help anyway. Well, then fine. We don't really need to see him.
Mm-hmm.
That, in addition, I think the month, give or take,
mm-hmm.
of paralysis that occurred after McCarthy was removed.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really wanted to see that again.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it's that. Now, what will be interesting to see is when Johnson moves forward now with this next big stone that he's got to carry up the hill,
mm-hmm.
is will they actually be able to get a continuing resolution through the House of Representatives?
Mm-hmm.
There are an awful lot of moderate Republicans who are like, why are we going through this charade? Why are we even pretending that we might shut down the government?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even going to take the first step towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stop this. Will that emasculate the far right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of what we were saying before that the AOC
mm-hmm.
is somebody who's willing to legislate, who's willing to take compromise.
Mm-hmm.
The big difference I see is that the Freedom Caucus isn't willing to do those same things. They would prefer to get zero
mm-hmm.
than to get 30%.
Absolutely.
And in that kind of environment where there are enough of them to tip the balance, becomes problematic. So I think as we move forward, we'll do more podcasts before the election, but as we move forward, I think the one thing you want to see, regardless of however it goes, you want the Democrats to win 35 seats or you want the Republicans to win 20 seats. I mean, you just want to make sure there's a governing majority in the party that's there in the House of Representatives, and we'll see if that happens.
And just sort of following up on that, so one thing that was interesting to me when Johnson became Speaker is everything I read associated him very closely with the far right, maybe not, like, the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
And whereas McCarthy never seemed to have a clear, like, ideological wing of the party, to me at least. And so I'm wondering, do you think Johnson has moderated just in terms of willingness to reach across the aisle, or he's also moderated a little bit on policy to help Democrats? And displayed more willingness to, like, actually pass things bipartisanly than McCarthy did.
I think he cares more about actually governing than his ideology. I think the Ukraine deal is not something that he
mm-hmm.
would have voted for
mm-hmm.
as a rank-and-file member,
mm-hmm.
but it was something he knew needed to get done
mm-hmm.
for the institution. McCarthy mm-hmm. seemed to be more interested in being Speaker
mm-hmm.
than actually making the institution work.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that failed on all fronts.
So would you say that, would it be fair to characterize Johnson when he was a rank-and-file member? Would he be sort of considered a member of the Vote No, Hope Yes caucus, like one of those people?
I don't know. I mean, I think he was definitely one of the Vote No caucus. I'm not sure he was one that was Hope Yes. I think
okay.
he actually did have
mm-hmm.
More conservative leanings
mm-hmm.
towards budget and appropriation type things. It's just that he recognizes, we don't have the Senate,
mm-hmm.
we don't have the White House,
mm-hmm.
let me get what I can get.
Mm-hmm.
The more that the right wing forces me to do things that are unattainable,
mm-hmm.
the less leverage I have in later
mm-hmm.
negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, he's a better negotiator.
Mm-hmm.
Also, McCarthy's, and anybody who's listened to me before has heard this, McCarthy's biggest problem was he could never count votes.
Right.
He never knew how many people were for or against him. He just decided, throw it out there and see what happened. And which is fascinating since he was the whip for a while, which his job was to count votes. And so you would think that that might wheedle you out from further positions, but no, in general, we just socially promote, and he became majority leader.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson, I think, is a little bit better about counting votes. I think he knows when people are lying to him,
mm-hmm.
And I think that helps to some degree.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So I also, originally when Johnson became speaker, I think there was a lot of uncertainty over whether he was sort of a caretaker speaker, or whether he will sort of make, continue to be the head of the Republican caucus, because obviously he sort of came out of nowhere. No one really
number seven in the Republican leadership.
Yeah. Exactly.
And he was like, and there were, it felt like 10 people offered up before him.
Right.
Yeah, three more or less, but yeah.
Okay.
And so do you think that he has sort of solidified his, maybe not grip on the entirety of the caucus, but what do you think the chances that, let's say Republicans win another, the House stays basically where it is, Republicans have basically another non-governing majority, would, like, do you think that's a speakership race that he could win? I guess it depends a lot on what happens in the next year.
It's one he could win. It depends
mm-hmm.
on the makeup of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the more interesting question
mm-hmm.
is if Republicans end up in the minority,
mm-hmm.
will he be the Republican leader?
Mm-hmm.
And I think where you only need half of your caucus
right.
to be the leader. And I think the answer to that question is most likely no.
So who would be the candidates to replace him? Or and what sort of, what would their ideology
be? Well, I think Emmer would be the one, or Emmer.
Mm-hmm.
Would be the Tom Emmer would be the one who's the number three position.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Scalise,
mm-hmm.
As Josh was talking about before, the people who were offered up before Steve Scalise is in the number two position would be the heir apparent. But you always have to keep your eye on Jim Jordan,
mm-hmm.
Who was the first to be offered up by the caucus to be speaker after McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan would probably have the inside track
mm-hmm.
on that, and that would pull the caucus even further right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of that will be dependent upon how the presidential race goes.
Mm-hmm.
If Trump wins
mm-hmm.
and they lose the House, which is a possibility, believe it
mm-hmm.
or not, then you could see a Jordan taking over
mm-hmm.
because it's become much more conservative. Mm-hmm. If you see Trump barely lose,
mm-hmm.
maybe you see an Emmer or Scalise.
Mm-hmm.
If you see Harris just run the table and end up with 320, 340 electoral votes,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to see the party do some soul searching. And that's where I'd see more of an Emmer-style guy coming in, or maybe even a Johnson being able to hold on.
So would Johnson, I guess in the sort of upcoming fight for control of the Republican caucus, what would Johnson's natural, like where would he be finding votes? Because it doesn't really seem like the way you're describing it, he has a natural constituency to be the minority leader.
I think it's everywhere but the Freedom Caucus,
okay.
which is interesting because
mm-hmm.
that's where he was before.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will be fascinating to watch where people like Tom Cole,
mm-hmm.
who's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee,
mm-hmm.
Or Michael Burgess, who's
mm-hmm.
now the chairman of the Rules Committee,
mm-hmm.
where they end up and whether they carry anybody with them. There's also going to be a heck of a race, I think, for the Ways and Means
mm-hmm.
seat, which will be important for the Republican caucus to try to figure out.
Was that Kay Granger retired?
She was retired. She stepped down as
okay.
chair of the Appropriations Committee.
Okay.
And that's when Tom Cole moved up.
Okay.
But, all right, folks, we are now well over, and I want to thank both Ben and Joshua for being willing to give me a little bit of time,
mm-hmm.
drink a little beer, and hopefully give you some insights
mm-hmm.
into the younger generation and some other things. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the beer.
Yep. And I have been evangelizing to everyone I know about how much better it is than, like, thermos water, like, the metal thermos-style water bottles.
Right.
And I blame you. So, I think, actually, I give you credit, really.
For getting you into the Nalgene.
Well, for normalizing what seemed like a super dorky water bottle.
And so that's right. I really object to calling it dorky, because I think that the Nalgene is for everyone. It's for dorks, and it's
uh-huh.
for jocks, and it's
uh-huh.
for nerds and antisocial
okay.
people.
I have to say, I think the fact that you and I both own Nalgene is not maybe helping them beat the dorky water bottle allegations, but...